Welcome, and thank you for joining us in the Restorative Lens podcast, where we bring together voices in the restorative justice community to share insight, practices, and perspective.
Each series of the Restorative Lens will be focusing on different topics within the field of restorative justice and give a space to hear from those who are most directly impacted or involved in the work.
The Restorative Lens is supported under the National Center on Restorative Justice, and we are your hosts, Alana Ojibwe
and Demoite Wesley. We're so excited to share this second series where we speak with facilitators from a recent National Center co-sponsored event. This event on equitable systems design for restorative justice provided an opportunity for participants to engage around key themes such as procedural fairness, access bias and decision-making, cultural competency, research and evaluation, policy and advocacy, and program implementation and fidelity.
The conversations in this series of the Restorative Lens create the opportunity to share some of these insights, reflections, and continued questions that came out of this event, as well as explore opportunities to address disparities within restorative justice implementation moving forward.
Thank you again for tuning in to the Restorative Lens, and we hope you enjoy listening.
This project is supported by grants awarded by the Bureau of Justice Assistance. The Bureau of Justice Assistance is a component of the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Justice Programs.
Points of view, images, or opinions in this podcast are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice.
All right. Well, thank you again, both so much for joining today. We wanted to kick off the conversation and just do sort of some grounding introductions. If you could share just your name and where you're physically tuning in from, where you're joining us from today, and either the most recent or a newly emerged recent activity that's brought you joy.
So I'm Seth Lennon Wynn Weiner. I'm here in Weehawken, New Jersey, close to a slightly better known place called New York City, and traditional Ramapo Lenape territory. And an activity that has brought me joy, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind is I've been starting off the mornings recently taking my 5 and 6 year olds to swim class. Bright and early. And so I got to see them emerge from their floaties and that look on their face when they come out of the water and they're saying, you know, I swam, I jumped in the water, you know, and the kind of courage that's needed to do something scary like that. And then that feeling, you know, of accomplishing it. So that's what I'm thinking about. It's brought me joy.
So Richard Cruz, I am residing and coming from Berkeley, California, the land here that it's held a lot of peoples back generations, all the way to the Ohlone and to others. And now us, it's been holding us and supporting us to live here. An activity that I've picked up recently is snorkeling. So I love snorkeling. And funny thing was, we were in Boston and I was like, is there anywhere to go snorkeling here? And everybody thought I was crazy. I picked up snorkeling and just being under the water and being able to breathe and just stay down there and look at a whole new world and really block out the top world and just look underneath. And it's beautiful. And the things I see, you know, I've swam with the sharks and just on coral reefs and it's awesome. And I love it. That's what I could do for the rest of my life, I would just go snorkel around the world.
That's a really refreshing perspective. Cause I think I often hear about people's like apprehensions and fears around the ocean. It's good that you found like joy. And my geography is a little bit foggy, but like, did you find a place to snorkel in Boston? No. We're near water. That's too bad. Well, thank you both so much for sharing a little bit about yourselves. You know, we're here to talk about restorative justice, access, bias, things like that. And so we're curious if you could both share a little bit about your like personal and professional journey to restorative justice, and how that journey sort of intersects with this topic of access and bias and decision making in restorative justice. And that's a big question. So whoever is ready first, feel free to tackle it.
My personal journey towards what is called RJ now is, so I was incarcerated, and we had started things inside while I was inside, because we didn't know what, I had never heard the term restorative justice. And so while we were inside, we created a community in one of the most like oppressed places. We created a community of accountability, a community of caring, and one where we could share our most intimate thoughts, traumas, the harms that happened to us that we have done. And it was a place of accountability and also a place of healing. And it was with a bunch of people that were doing it just because they wanted to do it and heal and be accountable. There was nothing that was going to come out of it. Like, we couldn't get rewarded, we couldn't get paid. And so we created those communities inside, and we created them on the yard outside of the normal groups that the prisons would run. This was on our own, and we'd have to create these on our own. And so we would have them on the yard. We would have them in different places where we could gather and meet inside of like chapels or substance abuse counselor buildings, treatment buildings, and things like that. We would meet and we'd create these own groups ourselves. And then sometimes we'd get permission from the administration to have the groups too, but we'd have to have a staff member in with us, which sometimes helped, sometimes didn't, depend on the openness of the staff member. And so, and then going into my professional is when I heard the term RJ, I first heard it from Sonia Shaw, and she was explaining it to me. Oh, this is what RJ is. And like, you know, it's about somebody being accountable and the one element. And she's like, you know, and, you know, there is a piece of it now that where restorative justice, I don't get it mixed up, but like restorative justice is, yes, bringing in a survivor. And I think the difference with us is we were doing more of peacemaking and healing work, because the survivor doesn't necessarily have to be there. And so RJ is like a concept of where there has to be harm, there has to be something. And so the professionalism of that came in as like, oh, there has to be a survivor of this that is actually involved in the healing work and is hearing somebody be accountable. And that's where I learned, oh, that's where RJ is a little different than what we were doing inside. And to the definitions that are here today, it's like RJ needs that harm to be there, needs to be polarized sides. And so then that fell into us doing surrogate victim offender dialogues inside, where we had survivors outside working on the harms that happened to them and people that were inside working on harms that happened to them and harms that they committed. And then bringing those people together to share stories. And that's where the RJ came in, and like we started building around that. And then our professional also, then it started to become a nonprofit, and we started doing, for lack of a better term, because the state runs it, is victim offender dialogues, and with those labels. And then we started doing RJC, which is restorative justice in the community, which is outside of the system, which is more of like non-punitive healing work that is actually about what the survivor needs and to work with the person who did the harm to see if there is some accountability and understanding and empathy that the survivor could hear. And so we developed those things throughout these years through experience of doing them, and realized that like none of them are the same. Every one of them is different. Each survivor and each person who did harm are willing to be accountable for different things and need different things in the healing process. And so being very nuanced with each one that comes across the table. And I feel like I've been talking way too much, and maybe it's Seth's turn, and then we can go back to access and bias.
Yeah. Thanks, Richard. Yeah. Enjoy hearing you. I don't get to hear that kind of origin story nearly enough, even though we get to work together. So, So the way I kind of, I come to this work and I come to be here, really, began with me as a teenager there in, Los Angeles, California. And I'm going way back, but I'm going to try to make it not too long. I'm going to, you know, match you for length, Richard. I had this really fortuitous, connecting with youth mentors who were doing a lot of healing work, mostly in South and East LA, mostly with black and brown youth coming out of incarceration and gang involvement, which was not part of my own biography. And yet being over there with just a couple of my white Jewish friends, like myself, we found a lot of belonging and a lot of help, you know, in our own growing up and our own development. And these groups were doing retreats in nature, poetry, music, sweat lodge ceremonies, you know, just a lot of like caring, consistent attention from safe adults, you know. And I wound up, you know, from that experience, having the chance to be around some of the, I would say, restorative work, you know, that they were doing. And I wound up going to college at UC Santa Cruz and got a degree in community studies. And part of that degree process required me to do a 6-month field placement. And so I went back to Watts, and I actually worked under the restorative justice leader, Akilah Shirelles, who I still get to be around sometimes. And then with another leader there in LA called Orlin Bishop, who is the chair of the board for the Watts Community Self-Determination Institute at the time was the name. And it was really profound for me just to be there day to day. This is 2003. And right at the end of my internship, Akilah's own son, Terrell, who was not a gang member, and just for the color of his sweater at a house party, he was shot and killed. And I was able to see up close how Akilah and some others responded to that loss by again getting people to put weapons down. And at the funeral and in the media saying, you know, we want for this 14-year-old who pulled the trigger healing. And we want to welcome that person back into our community, you know, in a good way, because we recognize that it's not an individual that we're up against. It's a culture of death and violence. And how do we really get to the root of that? And so years later, to everybody's surprise, I went to law school. And even greater surprise, I graduated, and along that way, I found a brilliant visionary law professor called Scott Wood, who is teaching restorative justice and helped contextualize some of those experiences that I had there in Watts with Akilah and with those other groups, Shade Tree Multicultural Mentoring Foundation. I also want to say Homeboy Industries and Tia Chucha's Centro Cultural there in Somar. For 3 years I had the chance to work alongside Professor Wood in the creation of a Center for Restorative Justice at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. And it's still going today. That center is kind of come under the fold of the Center for Urban Resiliency at Loyola Marymount University, and they're doing great work in restorative justice, mostly in schools, in restorative discipline in schools. And I went on from there to work with the Porticus Foundation as a program officer in their restorative justice philanthropy, and later with a healing center in rural Maine called Nabizen. And then for the last 3 years almost, I've had the great good pleasure to work alongside Richard at the Ahimsa Collective, focused on the Life Comes From It giving circle. So here I am.
Those were beautiful introductions. Thank you both so much for sharing so much in such a short amount of time. I really appreciate hearing these stories, and it is a really good, helpful grounding, I think, to diving into this conversation on bias and access and decision makers, because all of the, so this institute around equitable systems design, big topic, a lot of different directions that those conversations went, and all the topics are important, but this one in particular around access and the relationship between that and understanding bias and those who hold power and leadership around making decisions, that to me seems like one of the most complex and charged and important aspects of understanding how to talk more in depth around equity in the relationship between restorative practices and larger systems. So there's, you know, I'm excited to pass this over to hear your thoughts on how those conversations went in person. It seems like there's some, for something so big, there wasn't necessarily answers that came out of it, but some really, really good conversation. Just curious to hear, kind of bring folks who are listening to this in to kind of a snapshot on what is standing out to you from those conversations. So for the first part, curious to hear, you know, when we're talking about bias as it relates to restorative practices, processes, services, what does that mean? What does that look like? And anything that comes to mind when you think about how that has shown up?
Sorry, I said, we only have an hour?
Yeah.
Biases, they show up in so many ways. And I remember having this conversation, and I think one of the things is, like, really what we do is one of the things is recognizing and not being blind to the bias that we all carry based on our experiences when we come into life and when we're living it, is that that it's coming from especially decision makers when they get to decide where the funding is coming from. And so they get to decide how the process is, and that's coming from their bias of wherever that bias is from. I don't know where the funding came from, whether it's coming from the state and the government or private funders, but they all want something to come out of this process, whether it's numbers that are only measurable in an old way of counting. And what I mean by that is accounting of punishment, and accountability through punishment is now they're trying to apply that measurement to a different process, and they're bringing in that bias, and they're like, oh, so how many RJ practices did you do this year? How many people did you serve? And how many of them went to actual face-to-face dialogue? And so those are things that they can measure and say that they're a success, but it's out of a bias of wherever they're getting their bias from. I can't say each individual, but I'm looking at the system as a whole and what has normally and how it's been counted. And those biases come into our process all the time. And we have to report certain numbers, and we have to report certain outcomes to satisfy those who have the money, those who have the decision-making power to either continue the processes, because we can't do this for free living in this society. And so really have to be accountable to them, and private funding and state funding is even more restrictive into how they can do it. And the biases of like the kind of harm that you committed would actually stop. And because of how society has looked at quote unquote people who are sexual offenders or people who committed sexual harm, like they're unworthy of getting an RJ process, or somebody who has harmed a child is unworthy of getting an RJ process. They won't let you have those. Or somebody who is inside the system and isn't healed enough to have an RJ process. So I think those are where the decision makers are still using old measures to figure out, and their old biases based on this system, this punitive system's way of looking at things. And it creates biases in people. I hear it all the time, just not in systems people, but people that have actually been formally incarcerated that still have these biases that some people deserve it and some people don't. And that may be based on whatever their personal experience or what has been taught to them in the society of who's worthy and who's not. And so that's where a lot of the bias I see comes in, is these old views and these old beliefs that people are not looking into and understanding where they have came from, and then how those biases are denying access to others. And so that's where I see all the biases coming in on a regular basis as I go through this on a day-to-day.
Yeah, that's really insightful, Richard. I think it was maybe Desmond Tutu or Nelson Mandela said, forgiveness that is deserved is meaningless. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we're telling ourselves we can only bring something healing to somebody, to certain people, you know, who have been good enough or deserving enough, what are we really doing, you know? And I think each of us here are aware, you know, these restorative processes, practices have been applied successfully in places all over the world with the most serious of harms. And if they can work there, then why couldn't they work anywhere, you know? You know, going along with what Richard's saying here, you know, I see, as I kind of alluded to in my sharing earlier, when we were had the center at Loyola Law School, we kept getting phone calls from schools. You know, we were lawyers and law students doing this work, but it was schools who were calling, saying, "We want restorative justice here," you know, and which is great. I mean, it's such an important place to build a restorative culture and practices and opportunities for young people. And I think some of that is because culturally, we're more open and willing to do something, you know, for young people who have made a mistake, maybe than we are for adults, you know, and maybe than we are for adults who've committed certain kinds of harms. And, you know, so that to me is a kind of indication of some of the bias that we carry, you know, collectively about who this is really for.
Yeah, I'm appreciative of what you both share. That's, it's kind of a interesting take on bias that I don't think that we hear a lot. I think people think of bias as sort of like our interpersonal prejudices that we have. And certainly that comes into play and is important, but also how those biases play out at like systems levels, at the level of decision-making, and how, you know, bias is not just sort of the feelings that we have about certain groups of people, but our sort of socialized feeling around punishment, right? That like, that is the bias that we have. We have a sort of general societal bias towards punishment and punitive ways of being. And that also shows up even when restorative justice programs are, you know, getting started and are getting funding. And Seth, what you bring up, I'm a former teacher. And so thinking about like who gets restorative justice processes, even in schools, like who are they for? I also see how bias shows up in that. What is legible as a crime, for lack of a better word, or for a broken rule, what is legible as something deserving of a restorative justice process and of healing that isn't sort of meted out equally among students of, between students of color and white students, students of certain socioeconomic backgrounds. So I'm really appreciative of the perspective that both of you are bringing to this notion of bias as it relates to restorative justice. I'm curious, as y'all were again, in the room, as much as you can remember, and also just from your own perspective, did anyone sort of think about or bring up experiences of programs and processes that worked particularly well as it related to sort of dealing with bias and promoting equity? And again, if you can't remember from that exact conversation, just from your own experience, have you seen RJ programs really handle this notion of bias and equity in a good way, as good as possible, at least?
You know, one thought that's coming to mind in answer to that question, DeMonte, is some of these, I want to say, justice ecosystems where there have been folks really working together across organizations and institutions to create something that can be iterative maybe, and that can grow and develop over time. You know, I think about New York City, where the program Common Justice began. And at first I know they were only getting referrals secretly, in a sense, you know, in like a non-publicized way, because of the political risk that some of the prosecutors and defense attorneys and politicians felt that there was, you know. But as the cases were, having these positive results, then it started to grow. And then they started to get more meaningful referrals as well. And today, you know, I think that it's really expanded from just Brooklyn to the Bronx and other parts of the city. And then I also think about an organization in New York City called the Restorative Justice Initiative that makes it its work to be aware of all the different projects, opportunities, movements for restorative justice within just the New York City area, and to do the work of connecting, introducing, lifting up, advertising, convening, and just kind of advancing the work itself, as an ecosystem. And I think also of Nashville, Tennessee, where Richard just was benefiting from some of the work of Impact Justice and Sujata Baliga, who'd come in to work with judges, with nonprofits, with organizers, a really fantastic former police officer named Travis Claybrooks, who leads the Rafa Institute there and has really been a strong voice in articulating the possibilities for restorative justice in Nashville. And now they're talking about Memphis and other parts of the state. And so as more and more leaders are brought kind of into the fold of the vision of what's possible, start to be able to add their ingredient to the stone soup of what can happen, I think the biases also begin to get addressed. Because I think as we go along in this work, it's inevitable that we start asking these questions of, well, why aren't we doing murder cases? You know, why can't we domestic violence, whatever it is, that there's some limitation, and begin to bring that there? You know, I could go on and on about it, but I think that's part of it, is having folks who are willing to work intersectionally that way. So
So I'm thinking of other organizations around the country that I don't know how to say this, like, they may not be successful because we don't know how to measure success yet in this thing. So I'm like, but that I'm like, really, I really look up to, I should say, who are my mentors and who are doing things the way that I want to get to. One of them is Mike Milton in St. Louis, who is doing an awesome project up there. And they've created their own community where they're actually getting people who have been charged with murder released to them, to their community, getting them back out in the community. And they have their own community set up to where they can deal with it. If that person needs diversion, they're set up in their community. They're set up if it's a domestic violence case, where they'll take them out and where there's immediate separation and that people can feel safe. And then, so he's really like, and they have court watch and everything else that they're doing. It's more along the lines of TJ. And at the same time, they're doing all kinds of healing work. So the line has been very blurred. And like, they do work with the court system to get people out of there. They do work, you know, to get them back in the community and to do some healing work with that person instead of having them go to prison. And they're really being like recognized by the courts and recognized by people that, oh, these, they actually can go and have somebody work on the stuff that they need to be accountable for and hold that person in a safe space. So they're doing an awesome job. Mike was at this gathering we had in Nashville, and I want to get up there and go visit him. And he sent his people out here to go through a training we were doing. And another thing is, like, within the system, RJ, I think what Chesa was doing was very groundbreaking in San Francisco. And I was working with him, and it was hard. And it was really hard to do. He wanted to figure out ways to incorporate RJ more into the DA system and the punitive criminal justice system in San Francisco. But we kept running into systems of approval, basically. It's like, we wanted to do this. Oh no, we had to go higher up and get something done. But we knew what we wanted to do. And what Seth was talking about earlier is we were pushing up against the system to create levels of harm that the system has deemed as irredeemable harms. And so as a coalition, we were telling the state and them is that we don't want crimes that you think are redeemable. We want the ones that you normally wouldn't send to diversion. The ones that were like set up by Impact Justice and Sujatha is like, oh, these are all diversion type of cases that you could send to diversion because they're juveniles. They're like easy pickings. No, we want the harder ones that you normally wouldn't send there. And so that's what we're trying to build into it. And as you know, Chasa got recalled. And so it was, it's very hard, but I think those are the ones that I look up to that are pushing back and trying to change the way that the system operates, because it's so powerful that the people inside of the system are great. They want change. They want all these things to change, but then the system pushes back and then pushes them out. And those are the programs that I really think of that come to my mind when I think of like where we need to get to.
Yeah. So to kind of piggyback off of that, Richard, I'm wondering about, you know, like we always talk about this system, like this amorphous Oz, no one knows who it is, what's driving it, how to access it, control it. But like the reality is the system is made up of people. From your perspective and in your work, who are the decision makers that we're talking about? When we're talking about like these challenges and obstacles and these decisions and what you were just sort of naming of like, you know, it sits and there's definitely, you know, points and sort of intercept points, really critical ones where there's at a certain level, you know, there's decision makers at sort of one tier, and then the sort of power and in decision making, who are the decision makers that we're talking about when we're thinking about sort of like equity and access in the system, specifically around restorative justice and access to these processes and programs and services. So yeah, who are the decision makers that come to mind, and what power do they hold when it comes to ensuring equity and access?
No, that's an awesome question. So I don't think it's really the who. I think because a lot of different people hold those positions within like the government, the DA's office up in Sacramento or Washington, D.C. It's like there are people in those positions that are on the committees that are in the it's like when we were going through this in with Chase's office, we would get to a certain level and then there's a committee, an appropriations committee, this kind of committee, that kind of committee that would have to review our recommendation. And we, like, who is this? So we don't have the power to say yes or no. There's some committee above that that says yes or no. And then we felt like their decisions are being made based on votes, based on scarcity. And it's like, okay, so if I pass this and it goes wrong in fear, then I'm not going to get voted in. I'm not going to be on this committee. I'm not going to have the money to support my family. And so it's like there are people there. Yes, they're doing what they have to do to survive. But I think it's these offices and the ways these committees and the way the decisions are made through these committees, and like, oh, you need to vote or you don't need to vote. It's like we need to vote on this thing. But how is this? What is the outcome of this thing? And if the outcome isn't right, I'm going to have to pay for it because I said yes. And so that's where I think the decision makers get really bogged down. And if they can't see it working in a way that gets them vote or keeps them their jobs, which I don't hold against them because they're just trying to survive here too, is like, oh, I can't take this risk. So I think that's where the who is in those positions and in those committees. And because on an individual level, like I think most people want healing, want people to heal, want the goodness for people. But it's just when they butt up against that, these committees and these things of scarcity and like, I'm not going to get, you know, I'm going to have to do without, that it really impacts how the decisions are made.
I just think about, it's like, it's sometimes things are impossible until they're happening, you know, and, you know, that I think sometimes restorative justice is a movement, maybe social change movements in general, they are dependent on the power of our, maybe like our imagination, you know, and I know that there's been some success, like in California, They brought some groups over to Europe, you know, to see like Scandinavian systems and try to understand like that a completely different mindset around justice and how it's shaped kind of from the ground up can have some really positive results. Same thing with bringing folks to New Zealand and elsewhere, you know, and then people can come back from that. And I think that, you know, it was, you know, they say nothing's more powerful than an idea whose time has come. You know, it's Buckminster Fuller, you know, one of the great imaginations of recent time. And as that idea moves around, all of a sudden it's happening, you know. And I think what Richard's describing is there's a fear. I think, you know, sometimes, especially in the kind of like these bureaucratic positions, you know, people don't really get paid to say yes. nobody loses their job for saying no. You know what I mean? And so let me just say no. And so we have to overcome that tendency. And in order to do that, we have to really hold people's hand and say, look, this is for real. You know, and sometimes in order to be convinced that way, we have to see it up close, experience it in some way, you know, and again, going back to people like Sujatha and Impact Justice, others that have kind of done that work to articulate that, to walk step by step with different system actors to try and overcome that limitation and that bias, you know. I also think that sometimes we have to follow the money, you know, and say, you know, are people getting paid for maintaining the status quo, you know, or also how is a restorative justice system being financed? I'm thinking of a project I visited years and years ago now, where a group was getting paid to facilitate by the case. They're getting paid per case. And so they were getting referrals from big box chain stores for cases regarding shoplifting. And then they had facilitators who they would bring in the loss prevention specialist, you know, from it was JCPenney, something like that at the time, you know, as the quote unquote victim, you know. And I remember sitting there watching, they had this young person who'd been charged with shoplifting, and then this loss prevention specialist that got up to go to the bathroom, and the facilitator said, well, just go ahead and tell us what happened. He said, well, she's not here. And, you know, the facilitator kind of looked at their watch and said, well, we only got 15 minutes for this, you know, so let's just keep it moving. You know, you can see what are the motivations? Why is it like that? You know, how did it lose the spirit to that degree? Why is the quality so low? And I think it's because of the way that it's being financed, you know, and maybe it's also worth saying, you know, in relation to bias in our Life Comes From It work, you know, as we started out, we recognized, thanks in part to Edgar Villanueva's great work, Decolonizing Wealth, that the field of philanthropy, you know, less than 10% of philanthropic dollars are going to projects led by people of color, you know, and it's like less than probably 1% to indigenous led projects, you know, and more than 90% of philanthropic initiatives are led by, you know, white people. And so we made the choice there to resource BIPOC-led projects exclusively. And we have an all BIPOC advisory board that makes decisions. And so we try to lean into that bias too. And so I think that part of what we're doing here is we have to become aware of what the biases are and then try to design something within our projects that can attend to it.
Beautiful. Yeah. Thank you both so much. Mm-hmm. Again, you kind of preempted what was going to be my last question, which was about like the political risk often associated with poor decision makers when it comes to being proponents of restorative justice. Richard, you mentioned Chesa Boudin of San Francisco. There is a current recall for District Attorney Price in Alameda County for similarly this notion of being soft on crime for being invested in restorative justice processes. And so my question was going to be focused on the decision makers, but now I kind of want to flip it and ask, like, What is the power of people who are maybe not in those formal positions of decision-making to, for lack of a better word, put pressure on decision makers, or to, for maybe a softer term, hold their hand, as you mentioned, hold their hand through this change or this push towards restorative justice? What can people who are not in those formal positions of decision making do to be proponents of restorative justice and access to equitable restorative justice processes and programs? Big question, but any thoughts there?
I mean, this is a great example. It's like, yes, Chesa got kicked out, but he's not quitting. And he's not quitting, and he's got a group of people around him that aren't in this, that aren't these decision makers in these bureaucracies that are still encouraging him. And even, I think he just got a job at Berkeley. And so he hasn't stopped the fight. He just had to maneuver around what was happening. And so I think to keep encouraging him, to keep backing him up, and like whatever he needs in support, and like validating that what he was doing was correct. And actually that's why he was thrown out, because it was actually doing some healing work. It was actually moving towards the right direction. And there is a, you know, that support in itself, and him and his mother and his father that were have been in this struggle for so long, like those are the things that we've seen the change. We've seen it changing. I'm a part of the change. And so we know it is changing. There's little steps, but we're going to get there. We're going to have a lot of failures to where we get there. And people are going to be kicked out of office that are going to be harmed. They're going to be, you know, in this struggle, they're going to be used as mortars. And so, but to keep supporting them in any way we can, and not discard them because they lost a powerful position. So you're not discarded. You're not going to be canceled out. Like, that's not going to happen. We still got you. Let's just go in another direction for you. So just keep supporting, I think, and validating what that healing work that is being done.
Yeah. Thank you. So I'm hearing your question, Demoite, kind of, you know, no matter who we are and what we're doing, how do we contribute to this change? You know, how do we help invite in a different way of being, you know, in these systems that as we know them? And, I think back Howard Zaire's first book, as I remember it, is called Changing Lenses. You know, Howard Zaire, we talk about as, you know, a thought leader in this movement from decades back. And I think it's really just that, you know, how can I put on a restorative lens with the work that I'm doing in the moment that I'm in, with the folks that I'm with, in the organization that I'm in the conflicts that I'm coming across? You know, maybe there's you know, it's clear where that kind of there's a barrier that maybe doesn't need to be there. There's a bias that's being upheld. And I think that probably in most of these cases at this point, 2023, we can find examples of where that bias has been broken, you know, with a positive result, you know, and I think we all have the power to lift up these examples of restoration, of healing, of right relationship, of justice with care and accountability, you know, over punishment. And the more that we do that, the way I see it, we move ourselves along, you know, that much closer. We're all really empowered to do that. I you know, I talked about my children earlier. They may try to help me walk my talk every day, you know, as a parent, you know, in our everyday lives. There's opportunities all day long in my experience. So I'll say that.
So we are coming to the wrap up of our conversation, and I love a good audible move. So we had a different closing question, but I love metaphors, and I love that we started this conversation talking about water experiences of joy, whether that's through the eyes of children swimming for the first time, snorkeling, just talking about changing lenses. So instead of the kind of classic magic wand question, if you could give a snorkeling pair of goggles as the magic wand, and it would change the lens in a particular way of how someone sees the world, as the gift that everyone who puts on those snorkeling goggles, they see the world in a new way. What would you want them to be seeing? Like an example of something that you'd want them to see differently that would move us along in a good way towards greater access, greater equity in our systems. I'm going to pass the snorkeling goggles to you, Richard.
Oh yeah, this came super quick when you said that. So yeah, if I could have everybody in the world put on some goggles and snorkel, and they would, as soon as they put their face under that water and they could see, whether it be a baby or the person that they love the most or they want to help the most in this world, and they could see that person and that person was either hurting somebody or being harmed, like what would they offer them? Like, and change your lens that way to where each person you're seeing is somebody that you love. If it's that little baby, or if it's a dog, or if it's, you know, your mother, like, and they were asking for help, what would you do? What would you do looking through that lens? You know, so that's where I would say that if we could change that lens to look at it as everybody, and it goes back to that, everybody is in relations. Like we're all related somehow, some way. Just look and like, how do you help? How do you support? Not even help. I don't want to get into that, but how do you support this person?
Yeah, I can't say it any better. You know, the word that came to me with those snorkeling goggles is just interconnected, that, and when we're all interconnected, when it's all interrelated, we're all, you know, all relations, like Richard said, then there is no away, you know, I can't cut anybody out. You know, I can't do something to anybody that I'm not affected by. And so then it's really a question of, how do I want to treat myself? You know, how do I want to treat my family? You know, and so I've got to get a pair of those snorkeling goggles and send them around.
$1 million new Shark Tank invention.
Yeah.
Equitable system design goggles.
A VR headset. Well, thank you both so much again for joining us and sharing all of your insights. Yeah, I hope that folks listening will take those goggles on and, like Seth and Richard said, try it out in your own life. See just how much we can do, the power that we have to sort of move the needle towards a more restorative world in our own lives. Thank y'all so much.
Thank you.
This project is supported by grants awarded by the Bureau of Justice Assistance. The Bureau of Justice Assistance is a component of the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Justice Programs.
Points of view, images, or opinions in this podcast are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice.